All right, well, thank you very much for the invitation to be back visiting Perimeter. And today I want to tell you about an area of my research in the field of jet substructure and how it's enabling searches for new physics at the Large Hadron Collider. Boost here, of course, refers to large Lorentz boosts. And the largest Lorentz boost that I'm going to have in this talk is here on the title slide, where at the Large Hadron Collider, we accelerate protons up to a Lorentz boost factor of 7,000. And the question that we want to answer is, when you slam together protons at 13 TeV, what type of new physics might you create? And one of the classic images that we're used to seeing in the field of particle physics is an image like the following, where we see proton-protons collide. We see a spray of particles coming from the collision point. And this is a particularly elegant event display where we see the production of two pristine photons coming from the collision point. And as we all know, if we're looking for new physics, what we can do is we can take objects in our event, take their combined invariant mass, plot that spectrum. And in this particular case, in the diphoton final state, what we saw was we saw back in 2012 a falling spectrum with a bump at 125 GeV. And this, of course, was the discovery of the Higgs boson. And now the Higgs boson is playing a central role in our understanding of the standard model. And it is joining its friends, the force carriers of the standard model, along with the quarks and the leptons. These are describing all known physics that we've explored thus far, at least in high energy colliders. So I'm starting with this image to emphasize something. One, this talk is not really about the Higgs. But two, this talk is really not about these pristine photons. This talk is about jets. And jets are just a little bit more complicated of an object to understand. So here again, we have proton-proton collisions. We have the collision debris going down the beamline coming from the remnants of the proton's interaction. And then we see these two collimated sprays of particles coming from the collision point. And these are these jets. And I can bundle these objects together and calculate, for example, their effective Lorentz boost factor. So here I have a jet whose invariant mass is around 250 GeV. Its energy is around 2.5 TeV. So if I were to interpret this as a fundamental object, it would have a Lorentz gamma factor of around 10. But in the context of the standard model, there is no particle with a fundamental mass of 250 GeV. This does not correspond to a fundamental particle. This corresponds to an emergent property, and in particular, emergent property of quantum chromodynamics. And this spray of particles starts off its life as being a short distance quark or a gluon. And this spray of particles could be associated with a gluon, an up quark, charm, down, strange, and bottom. And by the end of this colloquium, you'll certainly understand why I'm leaving the top quark out of this game at the moment. So we could do the same thing that we did for the Higgs discovery. We could take these two jets, calculate their dijet invariant mass, plot a spectrum, and look for bumps. And a spoiler alert, I'm not going to announce the discovery of a new particle in this colloquium. And also, these kind of garden variety jets are not really all that interesting for the story that I want to tell. The story that I want to tell is not about these garden variety jets. This story is about jets that look like the following. So here we once again have proton-proton collisions, but now with a somewhat different view. So we have a view where the protons are going in and out of the page. And we see a spray of particles going in either direction. Here we have an end view. And as you stare at this event display more, you could wonder, why am I making a big deal about this event display, whereas I thought the previous event display was not so interesting for my purposes. After all, this just looks like two collimated sprays of particles coming from the collision point, a dijet event. What's different about this event compared to the one that I showed you before? And if you stare at this long enough, you realize, actually, these jets are special. If I look, you can see that these jets actually have intrinsic two-prong substructure. You can see it a little bit here with those green calorimeter deposits. And these are not ordinary jets in a couple of ways. So one is their topology is different, this kind of two-prong jet-like. But also their mass is interesting. This jet has a mass of 80 GeV. And there is a particle in the standard model that has a mass of 80 GeV, namely the W boson. In fact, the jet on the other side has a mass close to 91 GeV. And this event is most likely actually pair production, not pair production, production of a W boson in association with a Z boson, where each one of those W and Zs has decayed in a hadronic final state. And you give it a large Lorentz boost, in this case a boost factor of around 16, and the decay products of the W and Z become collimated in the same part of the detector. So we can take interesting events like this, calculate their pairwise invariant mass for the WZ. And let me just show you what that spectrum is from a recent ATLAS study. And so what you see is you see a falling spectrum in the WZ mass distribution with not really any evidence for bumped anywhere. I guess if you're a true believer, this two sigmas thing at 2 TeV maybe gets you excited. Or what's this exciting event out there at 3.4 TeV? OK, as I said, no evidence of new physics here, and certainly nowhere in my colloquium today. But what's exciting for me as someone who works in this field is the caption of this. Here you can see a tiny little letters, WZ selection. That is, we're looking for electroweak bosons in this hadronic final state. And this is something that was basically unimaginable a decade ago. And now it's such a standard part of analysis strategies at the LHC that it's relegated to a tiny little footnote, if you'd like, in the caption of this figure. And so what I want to tell you about in this colloquium is I want to tell you about this field of jet substructure. And I want to emphasize two different parts of this field. One is the way that jet substructure is boosting the search for new phenomena. And we can use extreme kinematics, large Lorentz boosts, and jets in order to unearth potential evidence for new physics. And I'll spend some of my talk talking about that. But I also want to emphasize the way that actually studying the properties of jets have taught us new things about quantum field theory itself and actually helping us push the boundaries of quantum field theory. And I'll try to make sure I leave enough time to give you a kind of a complete story about one thread of logic that started off with trying to understand jets for new physics searches and ended up actually teaching us something about the structure of perturbative QCD. But because this is a colloquium, let me actually just, for the benefit of those of you who don't think about jets all the time, let me just tell you a little bit more about jets and their phenomenology before going into these two topics. Okay, so most of us are theoretical physicists in the audience. So if we're trying to draw the entirety of the universe as theoretical physicists, this is maybe what we draw in black and white, describing the 60 orders of magnitude of fascinating phenomena ranging from the size of the universe itself to the scale where the notion of space-time breaks down. 60 orders of magnitude, which we'd like to explore. And the Large Hadron Collider, when plotted on these scales of the universe, occupies actually a fairly large fraction of those scales. We start off with a 27-kilometer tunnel that's 100 meters underground. We have detectors whose size is around 10 to 20 meters in size with an inner radius of the detector that's around a few centimeters. Through these detectors, we thread beams. The intrinsic size of the protons are at the Fermi scale, but the beams themselves are around 10 microns because they're composed not just of a single proton at a time, but actually 10 to the 11 protons in a bunch at the LHC. And 10 to the 11, that's roughly the number of stars in the Milky Way. And so roughly speaking, you can think about Milky Way and Andromeda, those stars colliding every 25 nanoseconds. And roughly speaking, the number of binary collisions between us and Andromeda, that's roughly the number of binary collisions you get at the LHC. So, you know, 1, 2, 5, maybe 10. At high luminosity LHC, it's actually approaching more like 50 or 100 proton-proton collisions at once. And if we bring these protons into collision at high energies, then using Compton's formula, we can say that we're probing the TeV scale. Now, the dynamics that we're interested in this colloquium is going to be about the dynamics of QCD, quarks and gluons, which dominate actually proton-proton collisions at this link scale. And indeed, we understand, we think, the structure of QCD, a fascinating non-abelian gauge theory describing the interactions of quarks with gluons and gluons with themselves. But famously, the strong force gets strong. And so whereas at short enough distance scales, we can use perturbative QCD to predict scattering properties among quarks and gluons, because alpha S actually confines at a link scale corresponding roughly to the radius of the proton, the actual final states that I see, even if at short distances I'm colliding quarks and gluons, the final states that I see are bound states of QCD. So the whole zoo of quark-antiquark meson bound states, three-quark baryon bound states, recent excitement about the formation of tetraquark or pentaquark bound states. And jets are the way that we map the physics at short distances with quarks and gluons into the physics that we actually see in our collider. And as I'll mention later on, actually most of the jets that you get, they're mostly formed out of a pi plus, pi minus, and pi naught, the lowest lying meson states in QCD. So let me just tell you this whole story once again in movie form. Showing the sequential acceleration of protons around the CERN complex. So again, each of these dots is 10 to the 11 protons. being sequentially accelerated at the LHC. The injector for the LHC is the SPS, which is where the W and Z bosons were discovered in the 80s, but that's now just the injector for the larger Large Hadron Collider, with CMS, ELISE, ATLAS, and LHCb as the collision points. We go underground, we see the standard model in graffiti form on the wall, and in a second we're going to cross the Swiss-French border and descend inside of these superconducting magnets, where we see a cartoon rendition of a proton, a bound state of quarks bound together by glue, and this is what we're going to bring into collision at the Large Hadron Collider. And in this case, this is an outreach movie from the ATLAS experiment showing what happens when you collide protons in that detector. And at this very moment in time, we are in the pristine world of quarks and gluons, where everything is calculable in perturbation theory, where we think we understand its non-abelian dynamics, and as theorists, we would absolutely love to live at this one instant in time. That is sadly not where we actually detect things. We detect things at longer distances. And so coming from the collision point, these white particles correspond to charged particles. These yellow and green blobs correspond to calorimeter deposits. And somehow we have to figure out what dynamics is happening at short distances by disentangling the sprays of particles we see at long distances. And these cone white objects here are representative of these jets, these collimated sprays of particles with, you know, let's say between 10, 20, 30 particles within them. These are proxies for the short distance quarks and gluons that we're making, but the long distance physics is a more complicated dynamics that we'd like to disentangle. And I should say that figuring out how you map from quarks and gluons to this jets, this is an unsolved problem in theoretical physics. We don't have a closed form expression for how this happens. But we do have heuristic methods to understand at least some of the dynamics that are in play. So we start off with proton-proton collisions making quarks and gluons. And one of the most basic things that we understand about QCD as a gauge theory is that just like electrons radiate off photons, quarks radiate off gluons. And in fact, because it's a non-abelian structure, gluons radiate off more gluons. And that radiation happens in the context of perturbation theory. So when I have quarks and gluons made at short distances, they build up a radiation pattern of a gluon field around it. And that actually is the basis for these jets being collimated objects. There's a collinear singularity that forces these gluons to be collimated in the direction that the initial quark or gluon was going. So we have a description of this in terms of perturbative QCD, or in particular, resummed perturbative QCD. Then these objects form bound states, these hadrons. And most of a jet is actually formed out of quark-antiquark bound states. And 90 to 95% of a jet is formed out of pions and kaons, the lowest-lying mesons in QCD. And then we have a final aspect of interpreting the spray of particles, which is detection. And one of the exciting developments that happened at the Large Hadron Collider is that the mapping between hadrons and detection is actually close to one-to-one, such that you can really say that you're seeing individual hadrons in your detector. And that has enabled this field that I'm part of jet substructure, because once you can see things very clearly, you can now study detailed properties of the substructure of jets. There's one final layer of understanding, which is near and dear to my heart, which is that we also need to have a theoretical understanding of what's actually happening in this collision. And though I'm not going to make that big of a deal of it in this talk, just to say that the spray of particles that you get here can be described in terms of a quantum mechanical operator, the script E, that describes the flow of energy and momentum into a given part of your detector. And this energy flow operator and correlations of that energy flow operator, that's really what we mean when we say we're measuring jets. We're measuring a flow of energy from the collision point to a detector at infinity. And this object, it's built out of the stress energy tensor, T mu nu. But because I care about energy flowing, I just see the zero I component. And this T goes to infinity is telling me that I really just care about the flow of energy off an infinity. And indeed, there's some first principles things that we can understand about the structure of jets by using the fact that it has this more underlying quantum mechanical description in terms of correlations of the stress energy tensor. But again, I'm not going to focus that much on that in this colloquium. So hopefully this gives you just a little bit more of a picture about the way that jets connect the short distance physics that I'm trying to understand to the long distance physics that I actually measure in my detector. And hopefully you also get a sense of the challenge of how do you take measurements made on these hadrons and infer what was going on at short distances. Indeed, that's the challenge that I'd like to try to address a little bit more in this talk. Okay. So the fact that I've drawn the universe this way is partly just so I can emphasize a point. Jets are definitely a phenomena within the standard model. We have not solved QCD, but we're pretty sure that jets are an emergent property of the standard model, but in particular of QCD. But we also know that the standard model can't explain all dynamics that we see. In particular, once you get out to galactic distance scales, we know that gravitational dynamics are dominated by a new form of matter called dark matter. One of the hopes that we have is that we could actually make dark matter in the laboratory, and that collisions at the LHC could give us some evidence about what dark matter is. And I'm going to show you a little bit later one example of an analysis using jets to unearth the properties of this dark matter. At short distances, there used to be a question that we didn't know up to 2012 about the origin of fundamental particle masses in the standard model. And now we think we know the answer of that in terms of the Higgs boson, which allows us to extrapolate the standard model in principle to arbitrarily short distances. But this 15 orders of magnitude hierarchy between where the electroweak symmetry breaking is active and the scale of quantum gravity, the Planck scale, this is, of course, the famous hierarchy problem, of which there are myriad possibilities for what might or might not solve the hierarchy problem, ranging from compositeness of the Higgs boson to extra dimensions of space-time to supersymmetry. And in fact, if I weren't standing right here, I'd be teaching my own course on supersymmetry, which usually happens on Wednesday mornings, or just completely unexpected phenomena that we'd like to explore. And I could spend a whole colloquium talking about these possibilities of what physics lies beyond the standard model. But no matter what this physics is that lies beyond the standard model, if any, the way that you're going to discover it is by using the standard model itself as a probe. After all, the Higgs boson was discovered by understanding very well how to reconstruct photons, how to reconstruct leptons. And if you think that new physics has anything to do with quarks or gluons, then inevitably you are faced with a challenge of how do I process and understand jets? And at the LHC, it's really, at some level, all about jets. Jets, 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 more jets. Jets, 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 every 25 nanoseconds, jets, jets, jets. And for someone like me who comes from the Boston area, if someone tells me about a tangle of tracks coming from a central collision point, that's also jets. So this is the airport where I had a 3-hour delay yesterday trying to get here to Toronto area, and MIT is here on the red line. Obviously, this is a joke. This is an overlaying of the Boston subway map on top of a collision event from the ELISE detector. It's actually amazingly color-coded, this blue calorimeter cell, this red calorimeter cell. Even the tracks here are the same color as the green line. It's pretty awesome. What I also like about this joke, though, is it actually tells us something about the history of QCD at some level. That is, you know, jets, we've known about that for 4 decades. In fact, I was visiting UC Riverside a little while ago and got a chance to meet Gail Hansen. And one of the measurements that she did in 1975 actually is credited as being the first evidence that we have for jet formation. But at that time, kind of jets were a blah spray of particles going into some region of your detector. But now, 4 decades later, we have a much more intricate picture of what jets are, as represented by the green line, and that we can really look inside the substructure of jets and try to disentangle what type of new physics might be at play. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on for the rest of this talk. OK, so hopefully at this point, your eyes have become accustomed to these event displays. And hopefully by this point, you actually see that this event display here is a particularly interesting one. Again, we have proton-proton collisions hitting our central collision point. And if you're just to look at this very quickly, you just say, ah, die jet event, dime a dozen. But hopefully your eyes have now realized that this is actually a jet that has three-prong substructure. And most likely, these three-prong jets are not just coming from the radiation pattern that you'd expect from ordinary quark or gluon production. Most likely, you think that this three-prong jet actually came from production of top quarks. So top quarks famously have a decay pattern to a bottom and a W. The W decays to two quarks. So normally, we would think about the top as having a three-jet final state. But if you take a top with a mass of 170 GeV and give it a large enough Lorentz boost, the opening angle of the decay products scales inversely with the Lorentz boost. And so when the top quark was discovered in 1995 at the Tevatron, the decay products were widely separated. here in this kind of fairly garden variety TT bar collision event, or sorry, production event, you actually see that the decay products get pretty collimated. And because of this fact that as you go to higher Lorentz boosts, this collimation occurs, it actually means that we have to change our analysis strategy for looking for events of this type. So here is an example of a new physics search looking for a heavier cousin of the Z boson. You make a Z prime that decays to TT bar. And here, this is showing the limit on the production rate of the Z prime compared to the mass of that Z prime. And you see this dashed line corresponding to a transition in the analysis strategy. So when the Z prime is low mass, the Lorentz boost of the top is small, the decay products are widely separated, and the top is reconstructed as three well-isolated objects. Eventually, the decay products become collimated. Again, it scales inversely with the gamma factor for the top. And in this analysis, actually, a transition point at around 800 GeV is reached, where it's just simply more efficient to look for a single fat jet with three-prong substructure rather than trying to disentangle the three jets individually. And this particular search sets a limit around 3 TeV. And here, we're actually in a fairly hyper-boosted regime, where even the detector granularity of, in this case, the CMS detector, actually plays a little bit of a role and is a challenge actually moving forward to try to go to even higher Lorentz boosts. So the name of the game, if you're trying to discover new physics, is you want to figure out to the best of your ability how to disentangle different types of jets and where they might come from. And so here is the standard model once again, but now I've emphasized which particles in the standard model have a chance of giving me jets. So we've known for four decades that gluons, up, down quark, and strange quarks can give jets. Charm quarks and bottom quarks can give jets, but the particular way that charms and bottoms hadronize actually gives rise to a meson that travels for a certain distance before decaying, and that's represented here by that dot that represents a displaced vertex that you can use to try to tag the presence of a charm or a bottom quark. And here, the actual Lagrangian masses of these quarks and gluons is small. In the case of the gluon, the Lagrangian mass, of course, is zero. But this plus plus is a reminder that these objects actually come with a spray of gluon radiation that just comes from perturbation theory. And I'll try to give you a little bit more of a sense of how much mass you get by having these objects just radiate off soft and collinear gluons. So this is what we've known about in the past. But now, when you get to large Lorentz boosts, the W, the Z boson, the Higgs boson, the top quarks, the heavy hitters in the standard model, they have rather large masses. But you give them a large enough Lorentz boost, and you'll see two-prong jets, or even three-prong jets in the case of the top. And these fat jets with substructure happen whenever those objects decay hadronically, which is around 60 or 70% of the time. And if you want to maximize your discovery potential for the LHC, you really need to do a good job of reconstructing those objects. Just to emphasize something, the Higgs here dominantly decays to BB bar. So not only do you get a two-prong decay with a characteristic mass of 125 for the Higgs, but you also get these two dots here coming from the fact that you have two B jets in there. So you have B subjets inside of that one fat jet. So this field of jet substructure, at least at the applied level, is about trying to disentangle these various production mechanisms. And there's been a toolbox of approaches to try to do that. And I'll try to explain just a couple of examples of these coming from my own research. There's a gigantic literature on this field already. And there's two broad categories of techniques. One category of techniques are called jet grooming techniques, which are trying to get as best as you can good mass resolution on your jets. You can see these light quarks have intrinsically small masses compared to these heavy objects have larger masses. So good mass resolution is a great way of disentangling these different jet production mechanisms. And then there's also the jet topology, discriminating between jets that only have one-prong substructure versus these jets that have multi-prong substructure. And since we think that physics beyond the standard model might actually preferentially couple to these heavy objects, whereas these light objects might be backgrounds, you want to be able to isolate these heavy objects and reject the backgrounds from these lighter types of jets. So let me just walk you through these different categories, giving you one example in each. So in the case of jet grooming, let's take the example of a top quark. We make top quark in some new physics event. We reconstruct its mass. And because this is coming from a top with a mass of around 170 GeV, the decay products naturally peak at 170 GeV. And if that was the whole story, we'd just be done. because that's a pretty characteristic signature that you're making a top quark. However, that's not the only thing going on at the LHC. As I mentioned, you don't just slam together pairwise protons. You actually have multiple binary proton collisions per beam crossing. And this is an effect that's known as pileup. And so this thing that I'm trying to reconstruct, it's bathed in this bath of extra radiation that has nothing to do with the thing that I want to study. And this is actually from a, I think it's a 2012 study, which is relatively low pileup, actually. But you can see in going from red, from blue to red to green to magenta, you get this extra contamination that's distorting your invariant mass resolution, giving rise to a shift that would make it harder to identify the top quark. And you need some way of cleaning up the jet. And there's a variety of different techniques that are in use. One that that I worked on is called jet trimming, which is essentially just a noise removal algorithm where you take a jet, partition it into subjets, and throw out pieces that are below some threshold. And that sounds like a very simple algorithm, and indeed it is. But one of the advantages of this algorithm compared to generic noise removal is that this algorithm actually maintains some of the nice properties of perturbative QCD. Namely, this algorithm is infrared and collinear safe, so I can actually predict from first principles what this algorithm does to my jet. And I'll come back to that in the last part of my talk. OK, so we see we can restore a really nice invariant mass resolution by using these grooming techniques. And if that were the end of the story, we'd be done. But something that that is just true about QCD is that regular jets have mass too. So here is an analysis of ordinary quark or gluon jets, where I'm showing the spectrum of masses that I get in garden variety LHC collisions. So these are events that have the jet energy around 150 GeV. And a good rule of thumb is that the mass of a jet coming from perturbative gluon emissions is roughly speaking 10% of the energy of the jet. And it's, indeed, we see a peak of around 15 or 20 GeV in this spectrum here. And this peak is at higher values than the intrinsic mass at the Lagrangian level of those objects. I should just say something about this particular plot. This particular plot has a funny logo at the top. It says MOD, which stands for MIT Open Data. And in the black here is data from the CMS 2010 Open Data. And you might not know this, but actually the CMS experiment made public some of its collision data from 2010 and 2011. And we set out to actually try to do some interesting jet measurements with this data. And I can tell you about it offline if you're interested. But this open access to data, which is something that's familiar in other areas of science, is now coming to us in particle physics. And the hope is that by making some of the data public, one can actually test out interesting new analysis strategies on real data. Again, happy to tell you more about that offline. Now, in this case, I have a peak at 15 GeV. And you're like, what's the big deal? After all, these heavy hitters in the standard model, WZ, Higgs, and Topp, they're at much, much higher masses. And so there's a pretty big separation between these. But this is for garden variety jets, the kind of jets that were available to me in this open data release from the very, very preliminary running of the LHC. And by now, you know, we have jets that are going out in the multi-TeV range. And this factor of 10% still persists. So as I take this energy of the jet higher, 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 the mass spectrum also comes higher, higher, higher. And eventually, this peak structure, which is known as a Sudikoff peak, the Sudikoff peak crashes on top of these masses of the WZ, Higgs, and Topp, and makes it more difficult to determine just by mass alone what type of jet you're looking at. And so I can give you an example of what this looks like. So here are an example of two jets. They both have a mass consistent with the top quark. One of them actually comes from a top. The other one comes from a gluon that just has enough energy and radiation associated with it to fake that 173 GeV mass. And I've tried to color code this jet to try to make it look like three-prong substructure. So we see a red blob, a green blob, and a blue blob. And that works pretty well in the top case. My attempt to color code this jet looks like something that my 4.5-year-old son might try to do. It didn't do a very good job. And indeed, just by eye, you can really tell that this has intrinsic three-prong substructure, and this doesn't really have any intrinsic substructure to it. And so because you can see it by eye, you can imagine getting a bunch of graduate students together and playing the game of trying to disentangle top versus not. There's actually been a rise in machine learning techniques to try to teach a computer how to do this separation. But one of the things that you can do if you understand the radiation patterns of QCD is you can try to figure out, is there an observable, which I can analytically calculate from first principles, that also gives me information about the pronginess of a jet? And one of the observables that I developed, which is now in active use at the LHC, is an observable with the funny name of n-subjettiness, which, true to its name, tries to ascertain whether a jet is composed of n-subjets. This is an observable that's infrared and collinear safe, calculable in perturbation theory. And you can use it in a ratio form, where if you compare the 3-subjettiness divided by the 2-subjettiness, that tells you the degree to which the jet you have is really more likely 3-prong versus not. And so statistically, I can't tell, sorry, event by event, I can't tell whether a jet that I have is a top or not. But statistically, top jets will have lower values of this ratio of tau 3 over tau 2. Whereas quark or gluon-like jets will have larger values of this, and you can make a cut on this and statistically separate out an enriched top sample versus your background distribution. The specific way that this algorithm operates is maybe not so important, but for people who know about cluster optimization, this is actually a variant of the k-means clustering algorithm using the loss function that you would use to define the k-means clustering scheme in order to define the extent to which your jet is composed of n subjets. This works for tops with the ratio of tau 3 over tau 2, and two-prong objects with the ratio of tau 2 over tau 1. So we can now take these ingredients, these analysis techniques, and try to use it for a new physics search. And here's an example of a search from the ATLAS experiment looking for a heavier cousin of the W boson. The W boson in the standard model couples to a top and a bottom. And here, if I make a heavier version, I can make it and it could decay to a top and a bottom. And here I see a fat jet with three-prong substructure, which I can use tau 3 over tau 2 to isolate. I have a B jet that I can use B tagging to isolate. The top has a B subjet inside of it. I can use B tagging of the subjet to try to distinguish it. I can try to squeeze just a little bit extra sensitivity by making a cut also on this ratio of tau 2 over tau 1. Not shown here is this trimmed mass distribution, which allows me to get a good invariant mass resolution. And the combination of all these techniques does fantastically well. For a signal efficiency of around 50%, I can reject the background by a factor of 100. And so I get extremely clean samples that I can use to search for new physics. In this particular analysis, I just see a falling spectrum without a bump anywhere. So OK, no announcement of a discovery here. But the excitement for me in this plot is not in the absence of bumps. It's the tiny little subscript on the m here on the x-axis, m sub tb. That is the invariant mass of the reconstructed bottom-top system. And again, this is something that you wouldn't have imagined even possible a decade ago, and now it's relegated to the subscript of the label of the axis. Now, this reconstruction of boosted top quarks, this is the poster child for this field of jet substructure, and I mean that in the literal sense. So if you visit me at MIT in the Center for Theoretical Physics, you can see I have a bunch of posters of various conferences having to do with jet substructure. And one of the recent ones in Chicago took the three-prong decay of the top and made it literally the poster for that conference series. And you can see I've left some room on my wall for the upcoming series of workshops thinking about substructure, and indeed the one that's going to be happening this July is at University at Buffalo. And there's a huge substructure community enthusiastic about these different ways of reconstructing jets. But it's not just us. These techniques are filtering out into the broader LHC community and are being used widely in new physics searches. And in fact, the recent winter conference series had some results using these jet substructure techniques, the ones at Morion and at Aspen. And I just want to give you a flavor for some of the ways that jets are being used for new physics searches, incorporating these techniques. So here's an example of a search from the CMS experiment, searching for dark matter. So I said that dark matter was something that we might be able to produce in a collider, and we'd like to study using jets. If you produce dark matter at the LHC, well, it's dark or invisible. So it just sails right through your detector as missing momentum. But to measure missing momentum, you have to see something on the other side. And that something on the other side could be a jet. So these are known as monojet searches for dark matter. And what I really like about this CMS analysis is that it doesn't just look for garden variety jets, namely small radius jets coming from ordinary quark or gluon production. It is actually looking for also these large radius jets with two-prong substructure using a combination of the types of techniques that I've talked about thus far. And since we know absolutely nothing about the properties of dark matter, apart from its gravitational interactions, we don't know whether dark matter preferentially couples to quarks or to gluons or to W or Z bosons, so you want to use all of these together. And if I plot the results from the CMS experiment on the more standard plane of the mass of dark matter versus the coupling strength to the standard model familiar from direct detection searches, under a given model assumption, we can place limits on this plane. So direct detection searches place limits that's shown in this blue shaded region. For example, limits right now coming from, let's say, the Lux xenon detector. But for direct detection experiments, it's actually a little bit challenging to get down to the low dark matter mass, small coupling strength regime. But that's someplace where a collider has excellent sensitivity, and this particular substructure analysis carves out this region in the dark matter parameter space, again, by using a combination of both small and large radius jet reconstruction.
Do you know if the experiments have reached this Z neutrino kind of?
These ones are not yet at the. Oh, sorry, you mean CMS?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's.
If you recoil against the Z that decays to neutrinos.
Yeah, yeah, so good. So the dominant background to this is indeed that Z going to neutrinos.
Can they measure this?
Yeah, yeah. So actually, this CMS analysis, if I'm remembering, this one actually uses electroweak corrections to Z plus jet production in order to predict the background. And that's actually necessary in order to set this level of stringent limit. You have to know what the standard model would do, particularly with Z to neutrinos. And through a combination of a photon recoiling against jets, also Z going to electrons and muons, and theoretical calculations, including electroweak corrections of Z plus jet final state, that's the reason why they're able to set this bound. And so indeed, you're limited by that background. Yeah.
One more question.
Yeah.
The plot, you say there is a scalar mediator. This is a more question about the model assumption sometimes in these. The mass of the mediator is below the center of mass energy of the process. So does this happen here, or were you?
Right. So this in this particular analysis, that fact that you're pointing out, which is the fact that in a given model, you need to make sure that the mass of the, well, this is not an effective field theory one. This is actually a simplified model case.
Yeah.
But the mass of the mediator affects the bound, and that's shown here by the fact that we go down in coupling here.
Yeah.
But then there's this bizarre diagonal line here.
I see.
And that bizarre diagonal line is coming from the fact that what's being fixed here is we're fixing the coupling strength. Mm-hmm. And the way that we're scanning the dark matter nucleon mass is actually coming from adjusting the mass of that mediator. Yeah. OK, so let me just show you one more analysis, also from the CMS experiment. This is analysis for a boosted Z prime, so a heavier cousin of the Z boson. This is a case where you imagine that heavier cousin only has couplings to hadronic final states, so you wouldn't have been able to see it in leptonic channels. And if you have proton-proton collisions making either a Z or a Z prime, this is actually something in the all-hadronic channel, which is extremely difficult to see, because this is just relatively low-mass hadronic activity, completely swamped by jets. But in this analysis, you can use the trick from the dark matter search, use a recoiling jet to boost your system to give this a large momentum. And then using a combination of jet substructure techniques, you can look at the invariant mass of that boosted object. And here, actually, I get to show you a bump, because I get to show you the mass spectrum of this object. This is a mass as reconstructed with an algorithm called soft drop, which I'll describe in the last part of my talk. And this falling spectrum that you see has a bump at it. Oh my god, we've discovered a new particle. Well, we discovered something new at 80 and 91 GeV. We have rediscovered the W and the Z bosons, which, as I mentioned, were discovered at SPS. And in fact, in this regime between 100 and 300 GeV, this analysis is able to set stronger bounds than any other experiment since those SPS days. And again, it's through a combination of this grooming technique, in this case soft drop, two-prong discriminants, this N sub jettiness observable, as well as some special sauce, a decorrelation technique to make sure you don't artificially generate any bumps in the spectrum. Proof of principle that we can reconstruct the W and Z, absence of bumps. Either you're depressed because you haven't seen new physics, or you're really excited that we're pushing the boundaries of our knowledge by using hadronic final states.
So if by any chance one would have seen an excess of, say, 100 GeV or 120, would be then the strategy to lower the energy of the LHC and kind of run at those energies? I mean, would the new, if you like redo the UA1 or UA2 with the higher luminosity, will you have a better reach for new physics?
So it's actually an interesting question whether you can go below the injector energy at the LHC. Mm-hmm. So actually, I'm not sure whether you can do collisions at
400 GeV.
Yeah, can you do? I don't know whether you can actually do collisions at 400 GeV. I guess the lesson that I take from this analysis is that you have a pretty large sample size already, even if you pay the price of having initial state radiation, that actually we're not yet in a regime where it's obvious that that's what you want to do. And it may be that you could use an analysis like this to dig out information already. And then really the question you're asking is, if I go away from the boosted regime, are there analyses that I could do that would be able to improve? I think the answer is probably yes, obviously. But this analysis actually, for me, actually emphasizes that just with a little bit of hit on luminosity, you can still get pretty fantastic mass resolution here. OK, so just to save time, and so I get a chance to leave myself for the last part of this talk, let me now just transition to the last thing that I want to mention about, which is using jets to push the boundaries of quantum field theory. And this was, for me, a very surprising story, which I'll try to explain to you. Again, it started off in searching for new physics, and then we ended up learning something fascinating about QFT itself. So something that I find really remarkable is that despite knowing the Lagrangian of QCD for quite some time, there's been a renaissance in our digging into the structure of QCD over the past decade or so. I'm putting this QCD renaissance, particularly in the theory world, starting in 2008, because in 2008 there was a new jet algorithm, a new way of identifying jets called the anti-KT jet algorithm that was introduced in 2008 and is now the default way that jets are reconstructed. And it's pretty remarkable when there's an algorithm that theorists-like and experimentalists-like, and we can agree on this particular jet definition when we're measuring jet cross-sections. Over the same period of time, there's been an absolute explosion in our ability to predict, at least in the perturbative realm, about the dynamics of QCD, multi-loop, multi-leg, as well as logarithmic resummation, as well as techniques more generally for understanding amplitudes and gauge theories, which folks here at Perimeter are working on. And then this field of jet substructure also had its start in around 2008 with some work by Butterworth, Davison, Rubin, and Salam emphasizing that this boosted regime can be useful for both searches in and beyond the standard model. What I want to emphasize is the combination of these two things, precision calculations as applied to the field of jet substructure, and see what we can learn. And we need to do this in the context of a particular measurement strategy. So the measurement strategy that this is going to be based on is the soft drop grooming procedure. And soft drop, true to its name, it takes a jet and drops soft radiation. And what happens in practice is I take the particles in a jet, I reorganize them into a binary pairwise clustering tree. And then after having built this binary clustering tree, I haven't actually changed the constituents of the jet. I've just reorganized them. And then the soft drop procedure is as simple as taking this clustering tree and just lopping off branches. And this gives now a groomed clustering tree. So what does this do for you? Well, it lops off soft radiation, which could be associated with this pileup noise. It dynamically shrinks the radius of the jet down to the size of, let's say, the object of interest. So if I'm looking at a boosted W or Z, this will dynamically make the jet radius kind of characteristic of the opening angle between the decay products of the W and the Z. And for this theory story that I'm going to tell, the key feature is that it actually gives rise to kinematic observables, quantities Z and theta, with a subscript G to remind us that I've groomed the jet to get these Z and theta. Theta is the opening angle between the root node of this remaining clustering tree. And Z is the amount of momentum carried by one subject versus the other. And I could study the dynamics in this theta G, ZG plane. The particular soft drop algorithm actually uses the Z and theta variables to decide when to stop trimming the tree, if you like. But the only thing that you need to know for this story is that there is a threshold Z cut, which tells me when I drop soft radiation, and a exponent beta that I can use to adjust the degree of grooming. And the way that this beta exponent works is that if I send beta to infinity, I don't touch the jet at all. If I send beta to minus infinity, I basically completely obliterate my jet. And the default at CMS right now is using beta equals zero. And from a theory perspective, we'll see that beta equals zero is particularly interesting. OK, so what can I do? I am adjusting my jet, modifying its properties. Can I predict the way that those properties are modified from first principles? So I mentioned that jets have mass. So I can take an ordinary quark or gluon jet. And I can say, after performing this procedure, where I drop soft radiation, force the jet to have a two-prong topology, can I calculate the groomed mass, m sub g, mass after performing this procedure? And if you look at the mass spectrum in simulated data, it looks kind of hard to predict. If I go from the black distribution, which is the plane jet mass, which has this characteristic peak called a Surikov peak, we can see that as I go from black to blue to red to green to magenta, I'm getting rid of radiation in the jet, so I'm pushing the jet mass down. But you know, there's a funny kink behavior, there's a hump, there's a fall off. You know, are you going to get a theoretical calculation that looks like that? And indeed, that's exactly what the theory calculation is. We in fact designed this algorithm to make sure that the location of this kink was predicted, in fact, correlated exactly with that Z-cut parameter that sets the noise threshold. And this behavior here is actually just showing you the suppression of the Surikov factor. Surikov factors are associated with double logarithmic structure, which on this log plot is just a parabola, essentially. And you're pushing down that Surikov factor in a way that's perfectly understandable from first principles. And something kind of interesting here is that if you compare the left-hand side and the right-hand side, the magenta, the green, the red, and the blue, they line up pretty good between these two panels. And the one that matches least well is the black curve, which corresponds to not grooming. And the reason why this is happening is that when you apply the soft drop procedure, you actually make perturbation theory converge faster so that you actually get more trustable distributions after performing this modification than you would if you didn't do the modification at all. So grooming is actually a beneficial thing to do. It makes perturbation theory a little bit easier to tackle.
What's the intuition for that?
What's the intuition? So jets have soft correlations between the direction of the jet and the rest of the event. And those soft correlations are something that's challenging to calculate. And in particular, there's lots of process dependence, depending on what the other radiation in the event is. And soft drop, not only does it drop soft radiation, but it also drops soft correlations. And you can actually factorize the properties of the jet more effectively from the rest of the collider environment. OK, so emboldened by this, strategy, let's do another theory calculation. And I mentioned that there was this momentum sharing variable zg, which I could calculate from first principles. And let's try to do our calculation of that. So you know, QCD textbook tells me what to do. Probability distribution for zg, let's organize it as a perturbative expansion, Born level plus alpha s corrections plus alpha s squared, and so on. And let's just calculate until we get our answer to whatever accuracy we can achieve. Okay, sounds pretty straightforward, except for on line one, there's a problem. At Born order, this observable is undefined. Why? At lowest order, a jet is just a single quark or a gluon that initiated the jet. I can't talk about the momentum sharing between two prongs if I only have one prong to deal with. So it's undefined. Okay, just throw that out and go to the next order. But at the next order, you have real emission diagrams, which have a sensible behavior, except for in the regime where these things become collinear. And this diagram, a virtual diagram, has 1/ε behavior, which is problematic. And the fact that this is undefined means I don't know what to do with this, and I can't use the virtual singularities to cancel against real emission singularities. And so I get infinity in perturbation theory. It's even worse at alpha squared. And what's happening here is that this is an observable that's not infrared and collinear safe. It doesn't satisfy the KLN criteria. I don't get cancellations of real and virtual diagrams order by order in perturbation theory. And therefore, I can't actually predict this distribution using standard perturbation theory. So I should have paid more attention in my QFT class, I guess, to know that I should have expected that this shouldn't work. Perturbation theory is not supposed to work for observables that don't satisfy this criteria of safety. But it's a little bit confusing because what I want is something that's, okay, I agree, it's unsafe. The probability for this momentum sharing, and again, the reason why this is happening is because I can't assign an answer to a jet that only has one prong to it. But if I just tweak my problem just a little bit, instead of talking about the probability of ZG, if I talk about the conditional probability of ZG given a finite opening angle theta, that opening angle theta, if it's non-zero, it forces my jet to have two prongs. And then I can very reliably calculate the momentum sharing between my jets order by order in an alpha S expansion. So the conditional probability, totally well defined. The regular probability, not so much. But come on, I mean, we know how to deal with elementary probabilities. Shouldn't I be able to take this conditional probability, multiply it by the probability for the opening angle, do the integral over all opening angles, and get this distribution back? Yes, you can do that. But in this case, this integrand is perfectly well-behaved in perturbation theory, but the integral is not. And that's not so surprising. Taylor expansions and integrals don't commute, and so it's perfectly fine to have an integrand with a nice representation, even though the integral is not working so well. But one of the things that we can do is use this expression and take advantage of the fact that we know aspects of QCD not just at fixed order in alpha s, but actually at all orders in alpha s. And these Sudikoff form factors, which I mentioned, are actually coming from resumming towers of Feynman diagrams. And in particular, this probability distribution for the angle, that's something that I know how to calculate in a resummed expansion where I capture the dominant logarithmic structure. And whereas at fixed order, I have a singularity when that angle goes to zero, represented here by this dashed red curve, at finite orders, at all orders in perturbation theory, this thing gets turned over by a Sudikoff form factor, giving rise to a different expression that actually regulates the singularity at zero. So I can calculate the conditional probability order by order in alpha s, calculate this object using resummed perturbation theory, now do this integral numerically, and the answer that I'm going to get out here is something that's well-defined in resummed perturbation theory, and it's something that we call Sudikoff safe, unsafe by the standard rules of order-by-order alpha s calculations, but safe when you include resummation to reorganize the perturbative series. So let me just show you what the result is for this calculation in picture form. So I'm going to show you the output of having done this integral. This is a probability distribution for the ZG. Ordinary quark and gluon jets measuring this momentum sharing, and I'm going to show you distributions changing this value of beta. So when beta is negative, this whole song and dance that I gave you about unsafety turns out to not be true, and you can do this calculation order by order in perturbation theory, and the lowest order expression has everything you expect from QCD, 2 alpha s over pi, the Keller-Casimir factor, 4/3 for quarks, 3 for gluons, 1 over z's, logarithms, you know, a standard QCD calculation. But you can see that this beta parameter is in the denominator with absolute values. So when beta goes to zero, this perturbative expansion blows up in your face, and you have to do something different. When you go to beta being positive, it's totally unsafe, but you can use the integral trick on the previous slide to do the calculation. And if you try to take that expression, which involves error functions and things like that, and try to expand it in alpha s, you find that the leading order expansion in alpha s is not alpha s, but square root of alpha s. And famously, the square root doesn't have a Taylor expansion around zero. So this is beyond traditional perturbation theory, what we call Sudikoff safe. But maybe this is not so surprising, getting a square root. There's other contexts where when you reorganize the perturbative expansion, you can get something that gives you square root of alpha s type behavior. But again, this expansion goes like 1 over the square root of beta. So when beta goes to zero, this expansion also breaks down. So what happens at this crucial point, which happens to also be the CMS operating point, what happens here? And it turns out that if QCD were a conformal theory, then there would be a change of variables that you could do to actually eliminate alpha s from the integral expression by a change of variables. And so you actually get an answer that if it were conformal theory, it would be independent of alpha s. Of course, QCD has running coupling effects, and that's shown here between the difference between the black line and the dashed line, what happens when you include running coupling. But roughly speaking, you get a distribution which is independent of the coupling with a 1 over z behavior, something that was not supposed to come out of a standard perturbative calculation, but is possible using this trick of Sudikoff safety. So we see this fascinating feature. It's unsafe but calculable. That is, using a calculational technique which takes an impossible problem and turns it into the integral of a tractable problem. We can look at simulated data to see how it behaves. This black curve corresponds to the prediction that I gave you on the previous slide. And then as I march from the red to orange to green to purple, I'm marching up and up and up in jet energy. And I asymptote more and more and more to this universal form. And this asymptotic behavior is actually renormalization group evolution to an ultraviolet fixed point, where at low energies, there's non-perturbative physics that actually distorts this distribution, which runs away as you go to higher energies and you asymptote to this universal behavior. The fact that it's 1 over z is not surprising at all. This is, you know, textbook QCD, the Altarelli-Parisi splitting functions. What's surprising is that you just get the 1 over z, because the Altarelli-Parisi also has collinear singularities, 2 alpha s's, pi's, and color factors. But this particular observable is one that picks out only the soft singular structure of Altarelli-Parisi. And in this sense, it's a standard candle for jets in QCD. No matter what jet you're looking at, a quark jet or a gluon jet, roughly independent of the radius or its energy, to a fairly good approximation, you get this universal feature. In fact, this has nothing to do with QCD. This would be true for abelian theories as well. And essentially, this is just measuring the singularity structure that we know from QED, from QCD, indeed from any gauge theory. So we have calculations, we have simulations, and now I have this open data from the CMS experiment, so I can do my own analysis and check to see whether theory curves, simulations, and these things all line up, and they do, so that's really satisfying that, that QCD works just as well on pencil and paper as it does in real data. But this is what I can do with CMS open data. What can CMS do themselves? And so I'll just end by showing you one final event display from the CMS experiment where they studied this type of momentum sharing variable in a collider event that looks like the following. So this looks just like a garden variety collision, except for, well, there's a few more green tracks than you would usually see. And we have one very energetic jet and then a dinky jet on the other side. And this is because this is not proton-proton collisions. This is heavy ion collisions. And actually, what's happening is you're seeing a jet being quenched by its propagation through the hot, dense quark-gluon plasma medium. And now you can ask the question, what happens to this splitting function when you have a jet that is actually propagating through a non-trivial medium? And so CMS has, in preparation, an analysis of this form. And the preliminary results are that if you start off with peripheral collisions, where you make a small droplet of quark-gluon plasma, basically, you get identical distributions between the red, which is the lead-lead data, and the black, which is what you expect, or what's been measured from proton-proton data. But as you make a bigger and bigger quark-gluon droplet, you start to see a distortion of this distribution, a separation between the red and the black. And this measurement has generated some interesting discussions within the heavy ion community, and I'm looking forward to figuring out what actually is going on here, what's actually happening to a jet as it's propagating through this medium that's giving rise to this distortion of the singularity structure of QCD. Okay, so just to wrap things up, I've told you about two aspects of this field of jet substructure. One aspect about boosting the search for new phenomena and new techniques that are trying to unearth evidence for new physics. And trying to capitalize on the high energies of the LHC, which force us into large Lorentz boosts, and the high luminosity of the LHC, which gives us the challenge of pileup. And hopefully you see that these techniques have been pretty successful at searching for new physics, even though there hasn't been yet a discovery using those methods. And then something that I'm particularly interested in, maybe not surprisingly, anytime you dig into a subject deep enough, you can discover new dynamics at play. And in this particular case, pursuing first principles calculations of the properties of jets have given us new insights into the structure of field theory. So let me stop here and take some questions.
Do you know to what extent machine learning techniques compete with n-subjettiness for resolving boosted top samples mm-hmm. from QCD?
Yeah. So the question is, how do machine learning techniques do compared to these analytic methods? And not surprisingly, you do better. Now, what we had to do a more apples to apples comparison. And in fact, this came out just in this past week on the archive. So let's take a machine learning technique, which is using the full image of a jet and using the amount of radiation deposited in each pixel and treating it like an image for image processing. And compare that to taking n subjettiness values for not just one subjettiness, two subjettiness, three subjettiness, up to four subjettiness, as well as adjusting exactly the degree to which you weight angles. You can make a choice about whether you want to emphasize soft physics on the periphery of the jet or collinear physics on the inside, and that gives rise to an extra parameter. So you take 12 of those n subjettiness values and compare that to a jet image type technique and with many, many more pixels, and roughly speaking, the performance is the same. That machine learning squeezes out a little bit more information, but n subjettiness, in some sense, captures already the dominant information necessary for discrimination. And now we want to understand to what extent that's really true. Is that just because we haven't been clever enough in our machine learning? Or is it really because n subjettiness does capture the physics that actually distinguishes the cases? And there's active efforts in that direction and creativity both on both sides, the deep learning side, figuring out what new algorithms you can use, and then what I like to call the deep thinking side, figuring out what structures of QCD can I exploit in order to get separation power.
More generally, what is the kind of the next step in this field?
So there are there's three things that are going on. One is just taking these techniques and just using it everywhere. And so there's going to be a deluge of results coming out using these techniques. It's migrating away from the jet aficionados into other aspects of LHC analysis. It's just applying it everywhere. Then there's this issue of machine learning, but more generally maximizing performance. But there's not just maximizing performance, but maximizing the robustness of techniques and balancing experimental systematic effects against the performance. And that's going forward. For me, though, I'm most excited by this last category of analyses of gaining a better first principles understanding of jet dynamics. Even if you knew everything about QCD in terms of, you know, someone just hands you the solution to QCD, if you come up with interesting observables, those observables can highlight different aspects of that final answer. And so there is some gain to be made by synthesizing our understanding of what observables we can construct versus the way that we can do calculational techniques. And I'm excited to see those things converge. And one thing that people are starting to talk about in this field is they're starting to talk about, can you get a competitive extraction of the strong coupling constant alpha s using jet measurements? Which seems a little bit crazy. Jets are really complicated and hard to reconstruct. Could you ever compete with, let's say, a lattice extraction of alpha s? And we don't know what the answer is, but because we can both choose the observable and choose the calculational strategy, there might be a place where we might be able to do that and really start thinking about jets in that more precision context. Already we know that jets can be used individually as objects to do these kind of multi-loop, multi-leg calculations where we study, let's say, multi-jet dynamics. But looking inside of a jet, that requires both fixed order and resummed information. And that's why I think there's a lot to be made by precision substructure calculations. And I gave you a little bit of a sense of that here. Yeah.
Is there any chance, that's a wild question, there any chance that down the road one could have some information about the polarization of the original particle that, say, at the start of the jet, like in exclusive channels, right? You can have various vector particles,
right.
K-star, D-star, and so on.
Yep.
And by looking at the distribution of final state particles, you can actually infer the polarization of, say, original vector particles.
Right. So this goes along in the direction of how much information is there in a jet, and how can I use it to do jet classification? And there's two different aspects to this question. The aspect you're talking about is I want to understand at the parton level what's going on. And indeed, there's a polarized splitting function that if I didn't average over all angles, I would have gotten something like that here. And so, yes, people are trying to understand that type of issue, though it's obviously challenging because it gets washed out. Even more so, I mean, can you tell the difference between different jet flavors? Can you tell the difference between up versus down versus strange? And there is effort in that direction, but it plays a role with non-perturbative aspects, and that's why it's more challenging to predict from first principles. But there's another aspect of what you're saying when you're talking about fragmentation, which is, do we understand, when you have a jet, the constituents inside of it, what its dynamics are? And there's been new measurements coming out where I'm trying to study simultaneously the property of the jet and stuff stuck inside of that jet. For example, there's a measurement from the LHCb collaboration studying the production of J-size made inside of a jet and trying to figure out what fraction of the jet momenta the J-psi is carrying, and that's already giving us some interesting information. If you fuse that with jet substructure, you can then ask, is there anything about the substructure of a jet that's correlated or not with the way that that fragmentation process has proceeded? And to the extent to which you think you have, experimentally, all the information about determining what's happening for these hadron production, those are measurements that you can do. And then on the theoretical side, it's our challenge to figure out how to then predict those from first principles. And we have a growing toolbox of approaches. So here I emphasize things we can do in perturbation theory, but there's actually a realization that there are more exotic fragmentation functions that you could study compared to the ones that have been known for decades. And those more exotic fragmentation functions capture some of the information that you're talking about, some more detailed information about correlations between where a hadron is made and what else is going on inside of the jet. And that's in the pipeline. What we need to do is to figure out what is it useful for. And of course, it's all useful for just understanding the standard model. So if we want to understand the standard model, this stuff is great. But for new physics applications, can we figure out how to use that information in some helpful way? And that's an ongoing conversation that we're having.